If you're just joining us, our guest is James Traub. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. His new book is called The Freedom Agenda. So President Bush issued a strong condemnation and warnings to the Russians about their behavior. Did that have any effect?
Well, the thing we don't know is exactly what Putin intended when he sent those troops across the borders from South Ossetia and into Georgia proper. And I should also say, from Abkhazia as well, troops came pouring in and have gone into Georgia proper. Did he intend to actually try to take the capital? And was he then given pause by the Western reaction? It's possible. I very much doubt it. I assume that Putin's goal all the time was to make the Georgians live in fear of what Russia could do if it wanted to, and thereby to gain compliance with Russian wishes. Probably also his hope was to humiliate Saakashvili, whom he obviously loathes, and ultimately lead to Saakashvili being deposed. He achieved all those goals. He perhaps also hoped to say to the West, don't let this country enter NATO. We will not permit it. This country is ours. It is not yours. He may have succeeded in that. We don't know. So my guess is that the statements by Bush and others had no effect at all on Russian calculations. I think that from the very beginning, Putin was going to do what he wanted to do and achieve what he wanted to achieve. And then the question would always be, and it will be as of now, how will the West react to this, what I would characterize as a naked act of aggression?
And to what extent is the West's leverage in this situation compromised by, A, Russia's enormous profits from oil and natural gas, and the United States military extension, preoccupation in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yeah, you know, it's very easy for the West to denounce military activities by rogue regimes and to punish them. This is Russia. This is not some small country. This is a huge, powerful, growing country with which both the United States and all major European countries have ongoing commercial, military, intelligence, and so forth relationships. And so what do you do? How do you balance the need to say this cannot stand, this is not how we behave in the 21st century, with the need to transact all the kind of business one transacts with Russia? So from the point of view of the United States, the big question is Iran. We are trying to keep the Security Council together on tightening the screws on Iran through sanctions. That means we need Russia and we need China. So Washington is afraid of losing Russia on that, and that may stay its hand when it comes to issues like, do we punish Russia by keeping it out of the G7? Do we try to keep it out of the World Trade Organization? And do we tell Georgia, yes, it can get into NATO? From the point of view of Europe, the considerations have less to do with Iran and more to do with very important commercial relationships. Germany gets 40% of its natural gas from Russia. Germany has seen what Russia has done to refractory countries. It tells them you can freeze in the dark. Now, Russia cares a lot about its dependability as a supplier to major countries. That is, it's willing to jerk around the little countries, but it knows that economically it depends on the big countries like Germany, France, Italy, and so forth, feeling that they can rely on Russia. Russia would be unhappy to have to use that weapon, but Germany could well think, well, if we get Russia angry enough, we no longer trust what they'll do. Maybe they will use that weapon. So yes, everybody has something to worry about when it comes to taking measures against Russia.
As we speak, events are fluid in Georgia, and there are conflicting reports about what's actually happening on the ground. But we do know that a ceasefire of sorts was negotiated with the French leader Nicolas Sarkozy. What are its terms, and what do they tell us about how this has played out?
Well, the ceasefire says that both sides will withdraw to the status quo ante as of Thursday, meaning that there would be Russian peacekeepers, Russian troops on the South Ossetian side of that border and on the Abkhaz side of the Abkhaz border. There are no Georgian troops that are now in Abkhaz or Ossetian territory. They're gone, so that's not really the issue. The issue really is, will the Russians withdraw to that line? So far, they haven't. So far, there's no signs of withdrawal at all, and indeed, there are continuing reports of ongoing hostilities. But then the question is, okay, let's say the Russians agree, and they do indeed stop fighting. They don't seek to take Tbilisi, and gradually the troops withdraw from Gori and Poti and these other cities in Georgia proper.
But by that, Tbilisi is the capital of Georgia. You're saying that you're talking about the Russians withdrawing from areas of Georgia beyond these two breakaway provinces, right?
Well, in other words, right now you have Russian troops inside Georgia proper. They have not sought, so far as we know, to march on Tbilisi, but they are present in a series of cities that are within 20 or 30 miles of the borders of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. So the ceasefire requires them to leave and to go back to the other side of those ceasefire lines.
To stay in the breakaway republics.
Right, exactly, because that's where they were previously as peacekeepers, and they formally are claiming that all of these military operations are in their role as peacekeepers, though God knows this is not a form of peacekeeping anybody has witnessed before. And so then the question is, okay, now what? Saakashvili will not acknowledge the rights of independence of either of these breakaway republics. He has always campaigned that he's the guy who's going to get them back. Well, that's finished. That's finished. You can talk about it all you want. At this point, those two breakaway areas are neither going to come under Georgian control, nor are they going to be truly autonomous. They have been effectively absorbed into Russia, whatever their formal status is. And so then the question ongoing is, will there be some way of creating a formal status for these two places, which Russia can live with, Georgia can live with, and the breakaway republics themselves can live with? That's going to be a long-term question. We can't worry about that too much right now. Right now, the big concern is get those Russian troops out of Georgia and then at least begin negotiating in a more in a less threatening environment.
So just to be clear, apart from the question of whether Russian troops stay in or advance in Georgia itself, the ceasefire essentially says the Russians get to stay in these two breakaway provinces and the Georgian troops have to get out.
I mean, is
that a humiliating defeat for Georgia?
Oh, utterly, utterly. I mean, for Saakashvili, it's a calamity. It's a catastrophe. I mean, though the actual origins of this war are still a little bit murky, it is clear that Saakashvili decided last Thursday night that he would no longer accept what had become a simmering low-level war in South Ossetia and that he would attack the capital, shelling, sending in troops and so forth, which in retrospect was a really stupid thing to have done, and which, at least according to my information, Washington had been telling him regularly, don't do it. He sent the troops in, and now the troops have been were crushed and were humiliatingly forced to return to Tbilisi. So now, in terms of domestic politics, Saakashvili at this very moment seems to be enjoying a wave of nationalist support, but it won't last long. And the sense of humiliation that Georgian people will have will make them turn on him. So I think he's now in a very, very dangerous place politically.
I'd like to get your take on what the presidential candidates, John McCain and Barack Obama, have said about this crisis.
You know, I think the statements have been pretty similar. And I was very struck when I, in the course of reporting this article that I wrote, that the chief advisors to McCain and Obama had surprisingly similar views of Russia and of Georgia. Now, Georgia is the one country or one of the few countries that would vote McCain if they had a choice to vote. It's McCain territory. McCain has been there. He and Saakashvili have a real love fest. McCain is a deep believer in democracy promotion. Georgia is a great example of American democracy promotion. And so he's come out quite strenuously in support of Georgia and criticism of Russia. McCain takes a more anti-Russian view than Obama does. And he has for quite a while, maybe in part because one of his chief advisors, Robert Kagan, a well-known foreign policy theorist, takes similar views himself. Obama, of course, naturally has a more accommodating view of intransigent countries. But the statement that he put out in the aftermath quite unambiguously blamed Russia for violating Georgia's territorial integrity. I suspect Saakashvili himself feared that if Obama won, he would no longer have the kind of support he had before, which may in part explain why he was willing to do this thing now. Whether or not that's selling Obama short, I don't know. What I can say is that I know the people who give him advice on this issue, and they seem to have a strongly pro-Georgian point of view.
You know, one criticism of McCain that I've heard, I guess, from liberal Democrats is that if we had adopted his view that Georgia should have joined NATO, that the United States might have been compelled to respond militarily to the Russian incursion. Is that a fair criticism?
Well, yeah. And I think that Russia knows this very well. And so it's been in Russia's interest to keep Georgia embroiled in battle because that prevents – that makes the argument that Georgia should not be permitted to join NATO. So that's a real concern. Technically, yes. I mean, if Georgia had been a member of NATO, you could have imagined a kind of 1914 scenario in which a series of events in a remote place trip a series of automatic alliances which lead to war. And so that's a very serious concern. At the same time, can we permit Russia to dictate the question of who gets to join NATO? And I think the answer to that has to be no, we can't. To be pragmatic, by the way, what in fact would happen is not Georgia and Ukraine would become members of NATO. They would be put on a track to join NATO over time, and there were a series of stages in that track before they became full-fledged members of NATO. And so that's what's being contemplated now. The next meeting of the NATO ministers will be in December when they'll decide if anybody new should be put on that track, and anybody new means Georgia and Ukraine. And it is a really grave question as to whether or not these hostilities will prevent Georgia from being able to join NATO, or the opposite, will persuade NATO members that Georgia has a right to the protective umbrella of NATO.
Well, James Traub, thanks so much for sharing your views with us.
Thank you.
James Traub is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and author of the forthcoming book, The Freedom Agenda. Alejandro Escovedo has been performing for more than three decades in a variety of styles – punk rock in the 70s, country and glam rock in the 80s, and as a singer-songwriter in recent years. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Escovedo's new album, Real Animal, is the artist's summing up of his own career thus far.
That's Alejandro Escovedo professing his allegiance to someone he's fond of, including his audience, in a song that deserves to be one of the big hits of the summer. Escovedo is one of the phantom presences in modern rock music, moving through the walls of various genres, inhabiting them with spooky intensity, and then drifting on. In the 70s, going with the angry lark that was punk rock, he did the San Francisco version of it in a band called The Nuns. They never achieved even punk rock size success, but they did end up opening for the Sex Pistols in 1978, a ghost footnote in history. He summons up this era in a very clever self-parody, a song that works better than any that the Nuns themselves ever recorded.
We don't want your approval. It's 1978. We know we're not in tune. We know we'll never be great. We made it this far. A little piece of fame. Up on the bandstand. Nobody knows no shame.
know we're not in tune. We know we'll never be great, he sings there, with a perfect mock sneer. Pretty soon, the 80s rolled around and Escovedo started making countrified rock and roll in the band Rank and File, with the brother team of Chip and Tony Kinman. So he wrote a song about them here called, sensibly enough, Chip and Tony.
All I ever wanted was a four-piece band. Yeah, we're coming on strong just like an accident.
The sound of this album is remarkably eclectic, as befits a career as peripatetic and questing as Escovedo's, who's moved from San Francisco to L.A. to Manhattan to Austin, Texas, and I may not even have that map entirely accurate given the way he's jumped around. It was produced by Tony Visconti, who produced some of the best albums by David Bowie and T-Rex. Escovedo has impeccable taste in collaborators.
Nobody left unbroken.
There's a strain of elegiac emotion coursing through this album as Escovedo sings about friends who've died and his own fragile health. A few years ago, he almost died from complications of hepatitis C. He's reportedly in good health these days, though, and has come through 3 decades of music making with a bracing distrust of misty-eyed nostalgia or weepy gratitude. One song here bears the title Sensitive Boys. He is one himself, but he's the kind that hard-boils his sensitivity to achieve both terse poetry and some generously open-hearted rock and roll.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Real Animal by Alejandro Escovedo.